On Thursday, February 10th, United for Justice with Peace, along with Military Families Speak Out and other peace activist organizations, sponsored an event entitled Economic Crisis, Unending War, and Right-Wing Resurgence. The featured speakers were Professor Emeritus and author Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bennis, the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. The talk was billed as In Conversation Between the Two Keynotes. Noam Chomsky presented for the first 10 minutes, then Phyllis Bennis took her turn at the podium.
I somehow thought Phyllis was going to talk first, and then I would be able to just say everything that I disagreed with. I'd have a You're lucky, you can do it. Well, I'll start over. I was saying that a couple of hours ago I got a letter, email message from Tahrir Square, from a surgeon who's working there. He had some pictures attached to it of things he was doing. One of them was his removing a pellet from the eyelid of a young woman who was hit by a police bullet or army bullet or Mubarak thugs, whatever it was. And underneath it, it said, thanks to the taxpayer of the United States. And that's expressing an opinion which undoubtedly is very widely held and is perfectly understandable. The actions of the Obama administration have been following a very familiar game plan, which is entirely evident to the people there. This is by no means the first time that the United States has been caught with a dictator who's losing the capacity to maintain control. The standard game plan is support them as long as possible. When you can't manage any longer, put them out to pasture. Case of Duvalier in Haiti, who's just come back, send him off in an Air Force jet to France with half the treasury in his pocket. Might do that in Egypt. Produce a very effusive rhetoric about our love for democracy and so on, and then work to reinstate exactly the same system as much as possible. And that's exactly what's going on, and undoubtedly the people and the demonstrators understand it perfectly well. Now, the demonstrations are a spectacular uprising, not just in Cairo, but now all over the country, labor strikes. It's something of the kind I haven't seen in my lifetime, in fact. But they're facing enormous barriers, and one of them is right here. And that's the one that's most important to us, because we can do something about it. It can't do anything about the things that others are doing. And as I say, there's nothing in the least new about this. There's case after case. And it is inspiring hatred, undoubtedly. And there's already a considerable background of hatred for this to grow on. I'm sure we all read the enthusiastic reports in the press about the WikiLeaks revelation that the Arabs support us with regard to Iran, which may or may not be true of the Arab dictators who were quoted. But what wasn't reported was the public opinion studies of Arab opinion. And those are very revealing. Not a word about it in the press. They were released last August by Brookings Institute, a well-established, respected institution, best polling agencies took the polls. It turns out that in the Arab world, about 10% regard Iran as a threat, 88% regard Israel as the main threat, 77% regard the United States as the main threat. Antagonism to U.S. policies is so high that a majority, 57%, think the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons as a deterrent to the real threats. But this isn't reported and really doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter in accord with a principle that is one of the main principles of statecraft. It was expressed, articulated very clearly by a high Jordanian official with regard to Egypt, and now the head of Marwan Muasher, his name is, head of the Middle East Research Program for the Carnegie Endowment. He said the operative principle is that as long as people are quiet and passive, it doesn't matter what they think or what they feel, everything is fine. That's a principle that applies to us as well, to the domestic population here, and it goes way back. We should understand that what's happening with regard to the wave of in Egypt has sources that go back very far. Back in the 1950s, President Eisenhower discussed with his staff what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world among the population, not the governments, he said, they're okay, but among the people. This was pretty remarkable because it was 1958, shortly after Eisenhower had compelled Israel, France, and England to withdraw from their invasion of the Sinai. So you'd think there'd be gratitude, and very briefly there was, but within 2 years it was gone and there was a campaign of hatred. And he wanted to know why. The National Security Council published a presented a memorandum, it's all secret then, declassified since, in which they said that there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports brutal, harsh dictators, blocks democracy and development, and that we do it because we want to maintain control over their energy resources. Not using them, incidentally. We weren't using them, but control over them. And then they went on to say that the perception's pretty accurate, and that's what we ought to be doing. And we're gaining what we need. The population is irrelevant under the Muasher Doctrine. And that follows right up till the present. As I say, the same doctrine holds with regard to the population of the United States, no matter how much people suffer, not by third world standards, but by our standards, under the programs, state corporate programs of the last 30 years, as long as they're quiet, as long as they're under control, as long as they're directing their anger, which is real, towards vulnerable targets, say illegal immigrants or, you know, teachers with their tremendous pensions or whatever it may be, as long as you can direct their anger somewhere else, and as long as they're not rising up, everything's fine. That's what's happening in Egypt, case after case, and exactly how it'll turn out in Egypt, we can't predict, but there is one thing we know. If we're quiet, the worst is likely to happen. The one thing we can do to support the demonstrators in the square is have open, vocal, supportive actions here, which show that they're not alone. That's something that's under our control, can be done, and I think that there should be at the top of our immediate agenda, plus getting people to understand the background of what's happening, why it's happening, why it's been going on for 60 years in Egypt, why it's going on everywhere else in the world, and these are persistent, unending policies.
Well, thank you all, and thank you to the extraordinary coalition that has come together to put on this event tonight. I think that we heard the term networking earlier, and I think that's what's very much called for. This is an amazing moment. We're facing really hard times in this country and globally, but what's going on in Egypt right now, I think, has given everyone an incredible boost of adrenaline and excitement and a sense of victory being possible in a way that we haven't seen for a very long time. And it's, you know, I came in tonight, I really didn't want to go to the airport this morning because I didn't want to leave Al Jazeera. I was watching it just nonstop. And I ran to the airport, and of course I missed my flight and got the next one, but I had that hour I was on the phone because I don't have a smartphone where I can watch things. You know, I called somebody and said, tell me everything that's going on, you know. And I think that there's incredible lessons for us. And there's incredible excitement for us to see this in motion. But we also have to be very careful. This is, on one level, a reflection of a global movement, and we're seeing the spillover effect of what's happening in Egypt, in all the areas around Egypt. We're seeing in Pakistan, we're seeing in Iraq, we're seeing in the Palestinian territories, we're seeing in Jordan, in Algeria. There are rising movements challenging long-standing dictators that were thought to be unchallengeable. And it's a great lesson for us. But it is a revolution there. This is Egypt's moment. This is Egypt's revolution. Our job has to do with what our government is doing. And it's not only, and I really do want to talk only about Egypt, but I won't, because I think we, you know, the fact that Egypt is rising, the fact that there is this extraordinary momentum going on, which some of you probably heard the news tonight, there was such expectation and such hope that Mubarak was going to stand down, was going to be forced to stand down by the power in the street. And there's some indication that he may have agreed to that some hours earlier. The fact that the US CIA director, Leon Panetta, said publicly this morning, we think we might see Mubarak stand down. It was very conditional, but even that indicated he thought it was going to happen. It may be that there was an agreement that Mubarak would stand down, and then he went rogue at the end and decided, why should I? Because I've got the US at my back. I've still got $1.5 billion. They haven't turned off the spigot. So why should I step down? That's where we come in. That's our job, is what our government does. We're not there to say what the Egyptians in the street in Tahrir Square or the workers at the canal in Suez, 6,000 workers of the Suez Canal walked out on strike. How fantastic is that? Because at the end of the day, the U.S. role in the Middle East, the U.S. goals in the Middle East, have everything to do with three things: oil, Israel, and stability. And Egypt becomes important for all three of them. I'm not going to go through all of that now, but I do think that we have to keep that in mind. So when 6,000 workers walk out of the Suez Canal and threaten to shut it down, that's huge. That's about oil, and that's about stability. When a new government could come to power in Egypt, which is not going to abandon the Camp David Accord, not least because that's why they get $1.5 billion a year, but they are almost inevitably going to stop collaborating with Israel on maintaining the siege of Gaza. That's the real change we're going to see. That matters. That matters when those workers walk out of the Suez Canal. So this is what we're seeing globally, and it's amazing. I mean, you can't keep up with it. You really can't. I sat in a coffee shop for an hour before I came here trying to write out a few ideas for some of my colleagues back in Washington about what it meant that Mubarak had just refused to do what everybody in the square thought he was going to do. Tens of thousands of additional people had come and joined the square when they heard that Mubarak might step down. The rumors were rampant. There were more than 1 million people in the streets, and they came because they wanted to be together when they heard that news. Imagine what happens when they found out it wasn't true. Imagine what happens when you have 1 million people in the streets and probably 70 million more out of the 80 million who live in Egypt who were expecting that, whose hopes had risen sky high, and suddenly they're dropped. Suddenly they have nothing left. This is not going to be an easy fight. Tomorrow is going to be crucial. And the role of the military tomorrow is going to be particularly key, because so far the military has said, we stand with the people of Egypt and we will not fire on the people of Egypt. And so far, mostly, they have abided by that. It's been primarily the police agencies that are separate from the military, mostly. But what's going to happen tomorrow when the military has made clear, we are not going to ask President Mubarak to resign? And he is our commander as long as he is president. And if he asks them, what will they do? That is why tomorrow is going to be so important. But it's also important for us here. partly because we have the obligation to demand that our government stop enabling what Mubarak is doing, because we are not standing aside. We heard Hillary Clinton say, we're like the people who are standing on the outside looking in. We don't know what's going on. Well, they may not know what's going on, but they are not standing on the outside. They are right in there handing out the cash. And as long as that cash continues, as long as those tanks are being sent, as long as those F-16s are being sent, as long as that tear gas is being sent, they are not outside. They are inside. They are enabling. And that's our job, to say no more. To say no more aid as long as the Mubarak regime is in power. That's for tomorrow. But I want to just talk very briefly, because I only have a couple more minutes before we start questioning. I want to talk just a little bit about what we face, because while there are these huge victories on the verge of happening in Egypt and elsewhere, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan continue. We are seeing people challenging the government of Maliki in Iraq, but there are still 50,000 U.S. troops occupying Iraq. We are seeing new challenges to the government in Afghanistan, and we are seeing the Afghan president, Karzai, the U.S.-backed president, actually standing up to the U.S. in sort of bizarre ways. But there are still over 100,000 U.S. troops and another 35 or 40,000 NATO troops and another 100,000 U.S.-paid mercenaries in Afghanistan today. So these wars are not ending. U.S. support for Israeli occupation and apartheid has not stopped because there is a crisis in Egypt. We talk about it differently, but the aid, the enabling of apartheid, the enabling of occupation has not stopped. So what do we have to do? The wars have not stopped since President Obama came to office. But I think it's very important for us to recognize that while the wars are the same, the political moment is very, very different. And that means we need a different kind of anti-war movement. Looking around this room, I would say that one of the things we have to recognize is that our anti-war movement needs to be a lot younger and a lot darker than the majority of this room. And wait, what that means is that we have movements that are rising. Some are very organized, some are still inchoate, but movements that are rising in response to the economic crisis in this country. And that's where we need to be. We need to be the ones providing information, shoring up movements who are saying, we need money in our communities. We need money for schools. We need jobs. 15 million Americans have lost their jobs. Now, is that worse than all of the people, the 40% of the Egyptian population who can't work, who are living below the poverty line? No, it's not worse. But if we're serious here about ending these wars, we have to do what's necessary to build a movement in this country, understanding that internationalism is still a foreign concept in this country. We can't depend on the moral issues alone. It's not enough for us to talk about how many Iraqis are being killed, how many Afghans are being killed. We need to talk about the cost of war, not only there, but here. The cost of war means money. The cost of war means jobs. Obama's escalation alone in Afghanistan, the 30,000 new troops cost $33 billion. That's worth 600,000 new green jobs here at home, with $3 billion left over to start rebuilding in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's the message we have to bring. Linking is the issue. Linking our work against wars and occupation with the work for economic justice, with the work for environmental justice, climate justice. That's our movement. Where does the money go? Whether it's 25% cut in the military budget or 100% cut in the military budget. If we're saying, where are we going to find the money for jobs? Look at the wars. We are spending $1 trillion this year alone on the military budget and wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That $1 trillion is the cost of the debt, and it's a lot more than the cost of what we need for jobs, healthcare, education, and infrastructure for everybody. And that's what our work needs to start with. Thank you.
Good. You brought in the link. Yeah, that's already a gender project.
Well, I like them.
Phyllis Bennis speaking on economic crisis, unending war, and right-wing resurgence on February 10th, 2011 in Arlington, Massachusetts. Before taking questions from the moderator and the audience, both Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bennis were asked to recap and comment on each other's statements. Here again is Noam Chomsky.
There's a number of very striking non-parallels in Egypt and in Tunisia and to an extent in Algeria and other countries. There's a real popular uprising. People are refusing to stay in their positions of passivity and maybe anger at what's happening but not doing anything about it. They're standing up, they're demonstrating tremendous courage. It takes to face the police, beat them back, the army, the torture, and so on. That's a pretty amazing achievement. The non-parallel is that it's not happening here. Of course, people here don't face the poverty and oppression and violence of Egypt, nothing like it. But nevertheless, over the past 35 years, shouldn't be much of a secret, there's been a bitter class war being fought in the United States, a continuation of one that goes far back, goes up and down, but it's been pretty impressive in the last 35 years, and it's had remarkable effects. I mean, as you all know, inequality now is statistically roughly at the level of the 1920s, but that's misleading, because if you actually look at the inequality, it's mostly caused by tremendous wealth at the top 1% or even a fraction of 1% of the population. A huge amount of wealth has gone into a tiny sector of the population, CEOs, managers of hedge funds, others mostly in the financial industries, but other industry. And for the majority of the population, real income's pretty much stagnated. People have gotten by, but by sharply increasing the number of work hours, very much higher than Europe, and by debt, and by asset inflation. Most recently, the fake money that was in the housing market, which all collapsed. And people are in trouble. The level of unemployment for, say, manufacturing industry is about the level of the Great Depression. And those jobs are not coming back because part of the class war has been, part of it has been financialization of the economy, part of it has been hollowing out domestic production. For the owners and managers and the banks, it's fine if production goes to Mexico, China, Vietnam, whatever, but not for American working people. In fact, for roughly the lower 40%, 50% of the income spectrum, it is the Great Depression, pretty close to it. How are people reacting to that? Well, they're angry, they're frustrated, they're hostile, they're irrational. Their concerns are real, but they're being directed away from the source of the problem. As I mentioned, they're being directed to vulnerable targets like illegal immigrants or workers in the public sector. There's a good reason for that. There used to be a counterweight to the class war that's always being fought by the highly class-conscious business classes. It was the labor movement, unions. Well, in the private sector, unions have been pretty well, not totally destroyed, but it's down to about 7% of the workforce, a tiny sector. Public sector the destruction of unions has been very substantially by illegal actions, which were authorized by the government. That was explicit in the Reagan years, and it continued through Clinton and beyond. So yes, that counterforce has been pretty much substantially reduced. Public sector unions have survived, and the attack is now directed against them. It's bipartisan. It was very dramatic during the lame duck session. Obama was praised by liberals after the lame duck session because of the achievement of bipartisanship. He was able to achieve a tax cut bipartisan. Just take a look at how it was done. There was one issue. Should there be a tax cut for the very rich? The population was opposed to it by about 2-1. Obama didn't even try, gave it away. It's his constituency. But in addition to that, of course, increased the deficit. But in addition to that, there was a tax increase, which wasn't called that, but that's what it was. Right in the middle of this, Obama increased taxes on federal workers. It wasn't called a tax increase, it was called a freeze. But if you think for 30 seconds, a freeze on wages for federal workers is identical to a tax increase in terms of the fiscal consequences. The big program for the next 5 years is a freeze on federal spending. Well, a freeze doesn't mean just keeping it stable, it means reducing wages because of inflation, population growth, and so on. So that's a tax increase for the public sector. There's a huge propaganda campaign going on, which has been pretty effective if you look at polls, trying to blame the fiscal crisis on the educational problem and everything that's happening on teachers and librarians, police, firefighters, their unions, which are allegedly giving them exorbitant pensions and so on. That's the real problem. Well, these are ways of controlling people. You control people by trying to prevent, make sure that they don't direct their anger and passion and commitment to the source of the problems, that 0.1% of the population who's absorbing most of the wealth of the country, not that, not the fact that Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, just a couple days ago, handed himself a $12 million bonus, not that, but rather the terrible surviving unions and the teachers and so on are destroying education, etc. Well, you know, if that continues, we're not going to be like Egypt. We're going to be like Egypt was until the popular uprising took place. And one kind of linkage, which at the moment doesn't exist but should, is recognizing that we have to overcome that. We have to dedicate ourselves to trying to get as much of the population as we can to understand what's really happening to them, to take inspiration from the astonishing, spectacular events in Tahrir Square and elsewhere, saying that, look, and getting to understand, if they can do it under horrendous circumstances, we can do it under a much less grim circumstances, which with much less opposition. That's a major task. It's in addition to the task that Phyllis mentioned, I barely heard it, of trying to put pressure on our own government to stop continuing with the policies that have been going on forever of supporting harsh and brutal dictatorships because they enable us to control resources that we want.
I just want to take off on one point that Noam mentioned about the degree to which the division between wealth and poverty in this country is rising so rapidly. And one of the consequences of that is it becomes very difficult when we look at the task that many of us have set for ourselves of figuring out how to stop the US from waging wars around the world. How do we talk to people in this country about our obligations, what our government is doing in our name? We claim to be a democracy. We claim that our government is representative, that it represents us. And we say that so much that people around the world think it's true. You know, people think that if the American people didn't want us to be supporting dictators, they have elections. They'd vote them out, right? People in Saudi Arabia say that. We don't have elections, but you guys do. It must mean that you like it. That means that we find ourselves in a position where our people, just ordinary people, not politicians, not rich people, just ordinary people, become vulnerable around the world because people are outraged by what our government is doing, and they don't make the kinds of distinctions between people and governments that, in the old days, a lot of our friends around the world used to understand. Very few people these days, because of US propaganda, understand the degree to which our elections are bought and sold by corporations. Very few people around the world understand the degree to which we are unable to control what happens in our government because of the power of corporations, most particularly now because of the new Supreme Court decisions, but in the past as well, because of the issue of money in politics. But what's the consequence of that? It means that when we think about how are we going to manage to stop these wars that, yes, our governments are responsible for, we can't just start going out on the street and expecting people to make that their highest priority when they're having trouble, they're working three jobs, they don't have health care, and they're trying to figure out what to do with their kids after school because they don't have any way to take care of them. What do we do? We can't ask, it's not a moral question when people are fighting for their lives, as people are in this country in a different way. We're not fighting an army that's shooting us down in the squares. But people in this country are struggling in ways that we haven't seen for a long time. And that means the work of building an anti-war movement is an entirely different kind of task than it used to be. And what I would say is that one of the things we need to consider, and this may be a little bit odd to say, I don't think we need to put the same energy into building a separate anti-war movement as much as we do into building an anti-war stream within this much broader river of mobilization that's rising around the economic crisis and the environmental crisis, that's fighting for climate justice, for economic justice, for housing, for education. That's where we need to bring information about where is the money. The money is there. The money is in the U.S., but we don't control it, and it doesn't go to education and housing and jobs. It's going to the military. That's our job, I think, these days.
Phyllis Bennis and Noam Chomsky making the case for the struggle for justice in Arlington, Massachusetts on February 10th. Afterwards, they were asked to comment on issues of the day by moderator Charles Derba, author and professor at Boston College, and written questions from the audience. Those comments will be coming up shortly. I am Chuck Rosina, and you are listening to Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bennis in conversation on economic crises, unending war, and right-wing resurgence.